Welcome, travelers. I'm Josh.
And I'm Lee Wanika, and this is Tabletop Journeys, where we will be your not-so-humble guides on the quest for RPG adventures.
Now, here's a message from friends of the show.
When four strangers meet for the first time, they unknowingly begin to unravel tightly kept secrets about their worlds. This place sucks. This realm sucks.
I don't mean to interrupt, but maybe speak about portals a little quieter.
You know how some people aren't really into science and magic mixing together?
That's just a story. Portals haven't existed for hundreds of years.
Armed with little true knowledge, but unfathomable curiosity, these four strangers set out in search of answers and form an unlikely bond.
I do see you, and I'd like to think that I'll be there when you're ready to talk about it.
He kind of relaxes for the first time around the group.
You keep putting yourself in danger for others, but who puts themselves in danger for you?
Join Ivy, Varys, Alara, and Ziva as they dive headfirst into the unknown. Follow us at Rainbow Dice Club on your favorite streaming platform, and find us at Rainbow Dice Club wherever you get your podcasts. Do you trust me?
Welcome, everybody, to tonight's show. Very excited to be talking to our guest tonight. We've been trying to go ahead and put this interview together for a little while now. Glad that the logjam has finally broken and we've got him on tonight. But before we bring him in, Mr. Lee Wanika Miller, good evening, sir. How are things going in the fantabulous state of Connecticut this evening?
Fantabulous is high praise. High praise indeed. I don't know if it's as well deserved, but yeah. We'll take it. Right? Never look a gift Josh in the mouth. No, things are going quite well. Who's to say? Last week I called you Joshua. This week I'm not looking a gift Josh in the mouth. I'm not looking a gift.
I have not quite recovered.
Things have been going really well, getting prepped for a bunch of good things. I spent part of Saturday doing really gamey things, painting. Folks who watch On the Right Path on YouTube in a couple weeks should see the actual vlog I did on it, but I painted up some nice little critters and such. Nice. Prepping for our Ankeg stuff. I have been delving deep into the dark blue seas as we work on that adventure that we've been putting together for Kraken Week.
Project Kraken.
And I continue to plug away at the factions book. So it's been a very busy week, plus just doing regular podcast stuff, editing and prepping and scheduling.
I am excited that, and very happy to say for folks that maybe haven't been watching the announcements on the Make 100 campaign that we did this past January, that the layout on that book is complete. The D&D rules have been reviewed, and I am currently figuring out how I need to bribe a friend of the show, Scald from Awfully Queer Heroes, to review our Pathfinder 2 rules. And then once that's done, then I'll be able to go ahead and send that book off to the printer. Then people will start getting the book, and I'm very excited for what was supposed to be like a short, short little dash off campaign. Like, we're just going to do a thing, and it stretched way too long. So it very much suffered from Kickstarter timeline expansion. Its timeline is a little beefier than I'd hoped it was going to be, but I'm very excited that project is finishing completion. Very much a labor of love, emphasis on the word labor.
Without a doubt. Yeah.
So speaking of projects excited to go ahead and come to fruition, I think that it is time to go ahead and trot out our guest, Caleb from Haunted Table Games. Welcome to Tabletop Journey, sir. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on. And yes, everything you were saying about a Kickstarter campaign very much connects with me. Emphasis on the labor for sure. I don't know that I know any Kickstarter campaign that has 100% stuck to its initial schedule that wasn't already done when the campaign began.
That was the caveat I was looking for. I would have thrown that in there. I said, there are a few that are done beforehand and you're literally funding so they can get print costs and shipping costs.
Right.
Those are the ones that pretty much go out immediate. There is one Kickstarter guy that I know that is so fast. It's crazy. Like, I have my stuff generally within 2 weeks, as long as I filled out my survey fast enough.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. But, and that person is consistent. Yeah. But the rest of us, we're out here in the woods. We are fighting wolves, squirrels, chipmunks. Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
And at the risk of revealing a little bit of the secret sauce, so we kickstarted our fourth big book in October, November. Mm-hmm. It was the end of last year that we did it, with every intention of having all of our principal writing done by the end of the campaign. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't too far after that the principal writing was done. But what we realized is that with three authors writing 9 beefy chapters, probably 200 pages worth of material, boy, does that editing process take an awful long time to go ahead and make sure that there's some sort of a unified voice in between there and everything like that.
It's we hit that same thing with our mission book that came out with the campaign. It has 12 writers, which when making the plan, you think, great, it'll be split 12 ways.
It could be fast.
Yeah. So let's get in here and talk about what we are talking. So tonight we're going to be talking about your game Triangle Agency, which was recently crowdfunded and has now been released. So congratulations, first of all, on getting the project completed and out there. Well done, well done. Before we get into asking questions, everything like that, tell us a little bit about Triangle Agency. What is the game and kind of what's the concept?
Yeah, Triangle Agency is a paranormal investigation and corporate horror tabletop role-playing game using an all-new system. The whole system has been built, I say all new, all systems, all games, all art is a product of what has come before, but an all-new system that is not like derivative of in a major way of another like existing reused system. The bulk of the game is about you as a brand new employee of a corporation that, again, not to give the game away, is an evil corporation that you're working for that is trying to collect and store them for study in a thing they call the vault. You, as an agent, have supernatural powers because you have bonded with one of these anomalies, and your relationship to those powers, this company, and your everyday life is like what the meat of the game really focuses on.
That is super cool. And it sounds a lot like, and Lunik, you may need to remind me of the title of it, but there was a game of corporate horror that we played with friend of the show from Obsidian Portal, Conan Liberian. And he also wrote a game that was very much about how you are a slave to the grind, so to speak, in corporate America, and what that, and the horrors that are entailed with being that sort of a grindstone, so to speak. Some similarities there. This is way more super, more like overtly supernatural. His was more just like printer jams and rebels that live in your staircase kind of thing. So
as the remaining member of the podcast who works for a corporate entity, there's fertile ground here in them there hills. Fertile ground.
Yeah.
We're growing stalks of wheat 20 miles high.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Much to think about.
Yeah.
And this is just Tuesday.
All right. Without any further ado, I think that it is question time then, Mr. Miller. D4s to the ready. 6 D4s. We're going to go ahead and base our initiative rolls off of the aim system here. So 6 D4s, and initiative will be based on who rolls the most number of threes.
So, yes, and I am confident that with my fan roll dice, there are going to be a plethora.
I'm going to do as like the referee here, the general manager. If either of you gets 3 threes, you win, even if the other one gets.
Yeah. I certainly did not get 3 threes. I, in fact, got no threes.
I did get 1 3.
Yep.
Oh. Thankfully, it was on my pride die.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Pride came through for the kid. Yeah. Even though we're not in Pride Month anymore, they are still coming through for the kid.
No, I got 2 ones, a 2, and 3 4s. So that's not. That's
11 not. Chaos from just those rolls.
Exactly.
That is okay on a whole lot of levels.
Oh, nice.
It was really dark, so I did have 2. Oh, yeah. Sweetness.
All right, Leonika, I guess that means you've got the opening salad tonight. So have
I actually generally don't like the first question because invariably to do a proper interview, there's a certain protocol, there's certain questions that have to be asked up front. And though I always want to know this answer, it's almost like I want to save my rolls for the juicy questions. I'm going to see if I can slide some juice into this one. Caleb, I am confident that our guests will be able to click on the links that we provide and that you have at your site and follow your career in tabletop writing and get some of this information. But I would love to hear in your voice, and I'm confident the audience would like to hear in your voice, your story. how did you get into gaming, tabletop RPGs, and what brought you to start this wonderful project?
Yeah, I'll do a big zoomed out one for fun. All the way back when I was like 9, I was introduced to Neverwinter Nights, the role-playing game, the computer role-playing game that came out a long time ago, and played that as a kid in their online servers where basically people would create entire like D&D modules themselves and then have people who are working all the time as like mods slash DMs were for you to have this persistent world to come in with a D&D character and play among a community of people who are all playing on the same server and keeping often the same characters alive for years and years. So my earliest exposure to role-playing was that, was being online and being given this like endless list of worlds that I could dive into and like role-play as characters within. And that was really what introduced me to myself playing tabletop games. My dad had played a lot of D&D when he was younger. I had never gotten a chance to really play with him, but I found like my way in through Neverwinter Nights. And then from that point forward, through my middle school and high school careers, I was doing lots of like forum role-playing and occasionally playing tabletop in person with my friends. Then, as an adult, fast forward a little ways, I started writing books for kids, doing a lot of writing practice in that world, writing fiction, writing stuff for primarily a middle school audience, and at the same time, starting a career as a professional GM, mostly of D&D. So from between, I think, late 2018 until last year, 2023, the bulk of my income was coming from private D&D clients. GMing. And then I got to a point where I was tired of playing D&D. I had accumulated all of this energy and thoughts about the tabletop world and things that were very interesting to me about the particular way that I was DMing and the way that I, and all the experience that I had gotten running like 3 or 4 games a week for multiple years led to me just being like, I have to get something out. I have to make what I've been thinking about. And then I think what we've created with Triangle Agency is really a big celebration and like tying together of my history working on fiction with my love of tabletop games of all kinds, which in the time in the middle of there, even though most of my clients were D&D, I had a regular local group that was playing lots of indie games and continued to play with a lot of people online and following the indie TTRPG space for several years. So that's the summary of it. And then another key component to this game in particular is that I wrote it alongside my writing partner, Sean Ireland, who I met working at a board game cafe in New York City where I started as a DM. And so he had also been working a little bit as a professional DM, and we started talking about this project together and ended up with this.
That is awesome. Awesome. As a New Yorker myself, excellent. I'm from upstate, however, not near the city, though several of my favorite people are city bound.
Including my wife, who grew up just outside of New York City and lived in Manhattan for 13 years. Yeah,
absolutely. So I always give shout outs to my folks from New York because I love to. I love that story. It covers like a lot of really cool things. The familial nature of the gaming where even if you weren't necessarily playing with your parent or that family member, that creative DNA that is part of what we do flows. Like, you just feel safe being able to do this. And I might be paraphrasing, forgive me if I am, but I really got the sense of that joy as you were telling that story and the remembering and almost a lament that you didn't get to play with your dad back in the day.
That's interesting. Yeah, you're getting at me there a little bit. But I think, just like you're saying, a big part of it is that because my dad was familiar with the world, I was given access to stuff like Neverwinter Nights. I was given access to those computer games. I was being shepherded through that world by somebody who wasn't scared of it, which is not true for everybody as a kid.
Sure.
I did have to go over to my buddy Marty's house a lot in my early D&D days.
Yeah.
We could play Legos and G.I. Joes at my house, but when it was D&D, it was at Marty's house. That was the way that went down.
Yes. Yeah.
It was a whole thing.
Yeah, and the other thing that I took from your background there, Caleb, is that with your background in other forms of writing, it exacerbates the point that like writers got to write, right? That's what we do. Like at the end of the day, creators create. That's really, it doesn't super matter what the medium is or anything like that, but those creative energies that's the way that they come out. And that's, so I love that you're able to leverage, or at least that you talked about how you're leveraging all these different experience, this writing experience, that kind of the path that eventually leads you down. And plus eventually winding you into private DMing, which being able to go ahead and make a living doing that. I have a
question. In New York City, no less.
In New York City, no less. Exactly.
Like, right? Yeah, I can only imagine. I have some follow-up there that we'll probably do offline at some point. But
yeah, right, exactly. Yeah,
it was a very lucky situation for me. So I think New York City is one of the only places you can maybe do that.
Yeah. I was going to make the joke that this is an audio podcast, so nobody's going to see this, but you said that you're recording in your restroom. I was wondering if maybe that was the entirety of your apartment there.
No, so I actually, I'm back in Georgia now. I lived in New York for several years. Back in Georgia now, I have a very nice sized house. My dog is super happy. The issue actually is that the other room's too big, so I had to come here.
Yeah, fair enough.
Weeping willows in the front yard. It's wonderful. All that good Georgia stuff. You know, I love it.
Yes, a crane flies by the river every day when I look out my window.
Cold peach tea in the fridge. Exactly. All right. So that brings it to my question here. So I'm going to ask the other kind of like obvious question that we ask everybody that comes on the show to go ahead and talk about their game. And that is about where Triangle Agency specifically came from. What are the games and the concepts that are within Triangle Agency's DNA? What are the building blocks that brought you to this point?
Yeah, there's so much. A big one that I mentioned to you earlier is the video game Control became super popular a few years ago, and it is a game that is borrowing a lot from the SCP Foundation, a sort of online, gosh, what is the correct word for it? An online compendium of works by many people, basically writing short stories about supernatural anomalies, items and strange phenomenon that are being studied by this government-ish organization called the SCP Foundation. Most of it is like short horror fiction. They're like little snippets of some very interesting worlds painted by different writers and given an opportunity, much like fan fiction, to rise and fall based on how a broader audience responds to whatever you made. And the SCP Foundation has this reputation and incredible community built around the idea that any one individual writer is not really the point of the project. It's all these people are bringing something else to it. Control, the video game, borrows a lot from that and from other corporate horror and supernatural media, and puts a big emphasis on the government agency side of it, puts you as a character trapped inside of this big government agency that has had something terrible happen to it and has you use your supernatural powers to fight your way out. I loved that game. It was my first experience with a Remedy game. Since then, they've come out with Alan Wake 2 recently. I went back and played all of those. They're all amazing. But at the time, I happened to see, while it was very popular, I happened to see a tweet from a journalist who I love, Keita Jackson. They were talking about basically something casual, like, where's the tabletop game that I can play that feels like Control? A very casual tweet, tweeted out by somebody who did not know me. And when I saw it, I was like, that's interesting. I haven't really thought about that very hard. So that day, while I was like, I happened to have been practicing with a design software called Figma, where I was like, just trying to see if I could design interesting logos or whatever, just for fun. When that came across, I was like, maybe I'll just make a logo. I'll make a logo for what I imagine a game like this would look like. I made a logo for Triangle Agency, and that logo remains the logo now, because I sent that to my friend Sean and was like, what if we made this tabletop role-playing game I just made a really funny logo for? And he was like, sounds great. And so then from that point forward, I started working on it. But what really came to be after that initial inspiration, and which saved a guiding light, was like, what do people like about Control and what is that pulling from? It became more about what I wanted to talk about, which is to say that a lot of this kind of media has a kind of non-critical love of the government. Sometimes it's critical. Sometimes it's a little more complicated, but often these kinds of stories, the backdrop is that you're working for this big government organization. Maybe it's a little spooky the government is doing this, but at its core, what a lot of those stories are about are characters who are functionally cops. X-Files is like that. To a lesser extent, there are some other tabletop games that put you in that position. And I was really interested in like, how does that idea change if it is a company, like an independent company that's doing this rather than the government? What does that open up for you? And what if we played a game in the tabletop space? Because a lot of discourse over the past several years has been about how D&D and other games like this wield violence not just as a fun game thing, but also, again, as a way to make you comfortable with the idea that you're playing a cop. A lot of them are designed around that concept, even if they aren't like super upfront about it. So I was really curious about, can I make a game that forces you to at least talk about that? Makes it so that whatever decision you're making, there's no way for your table to get out of having that kind of conversation. Like, how are we wielding power? What is it for? Are we interested in being an enforcer of any kind? that was like the core, that early on came out to be the core philosophical idea of the game. And then if I'm pulling back a wide variety of the influences that I think made it in, there are some wackier ones. A huge inspiration for me is manga, shonen manga, battle manga.
And so
the art and a lot of the abilities of the game, I think, are playing with what I think is tabletop games can borrow from those, which is that like something that happens in manga and anime that doesn't really happen in other similar genre to fiction is this emphasis on rules. The idea that powers have these like really specific rules and do these really interesting things with how like specific words and specific ideas can be layered on top of each other over a long period of time to create this like complicated series of cause and effects. Like in JoJo's Bizarre Adventure is a really huge example of this. And the X-Men have always been huge for me, and the both the successes and failures of the X-Men like metaphor over the years, and how well they've been able to tell stories about people with superpowers being marginalized and how not they've done that in other times. So I think a lot of that stuff all piled together into this big game about what it means to be in a situation that you have very little control in, despite feeling like you as a person have a lot of individual power.
That is, as you were talking here, I was reminded of an interview that we did, gosh, probably close to 2 years now, when we had Kiana Stewart on, who was they'd written a lot of cyberpunk RPGs. And the quote that I remember from that episode, because we were talking about how overtly and over the top political their writing was, and their stance was that all cyberpunk is political. End of quote. I get a lot of that in here too, where it's, you're playing on kind of that corporate almost in like in a Shadowrun sort of way, where like you are like the government is not the lion in the room anymore. It's this other agency that doesn't have to play by those same rules, that doesn't have to go ahead and follow those same edicts, that doesn't have the same checks and balances theoretically that the government does. So you're finding a way to operate outside of the system to give yourself more freedom, or to give the players more freedom to go ahead and do things with a different veneer on them. And I think that's really cool. So well done. Yeah.
As you were telling us that, I was thinking about the things that came to my mind. And I don't know if this is showing my age specifically, but looking at your artwork and the general setup, and specifically the video vignette that you had on your Kickstarter, I got strong paranoia vibes, like early 90s paranoia vibes. Like I felt that I actually was watching the video, and I actually remember looking over my shoulder a few times because it was just, it just gave me that.
That's
about 3 hours after we get done. Yeah.
So oh my gosh.
I may just watch it again just so I don't have to go to sleep. But it'll make for an interesting drive to the airport. But I can tell you that I strongly felt that. But as you were talking, the other thing that came to mind was the television show Angel. The final seasons of Angel, when they go to work for Wolfram and Hart, it seems to be exactly what you're talking about. They're department heads. They are huge within this company. But at the end of the day, they are nothing against the actual machine. And in that case, they're working for legit, straight up demons that are bent on destroying the world. Like, they just straight out and say what they are. They're not even pretending to be Tesla. They're just saying, we're here to destroy the world, right? Sorry, I got a little political. I got to rein that back in.
To cover those two, so the funny thing, paranoia is one of those that I'm almost embarrassed to talk about because I knew almost nothing about it going into this project. By the time I learned about it, I had already started working enough on the game that I was like, I can't read it. Because if I read it now, it'll affect what I've done. So it's on its way to me now. I have some paranoia adventures that I got last year, and I have heard so much about it now as a result of this exact thing, of being put in conversation with it so directly. And everything I hear about it, I'm like, oh yeah, they were thinking about the same stuff I was, and they did a great job with it as well. Yep. Angel, the reason I was like, whoa, was because we're again talking about my dad, which is funny. Welcome to Dad Chat. But that was like, that is like one of the first like adult shows I remember being allowed to watch. Like I would watch that with my dad because he was also obsessed with Angel and with Buffy. So you're probably right, but on a much deeper level than I ever would have noticed. Yes, that's a core reference point for me.
Yeah. Welcome to the Tabletop Journeys Black Leather Couch. We'll be using the bill for the session when you're done.
We quite literally exercise a lot of demons when we're done talking. I have always loved that show, and specifically those seasons more than any other part of the show. Mm-hmm. I was not the world's greatest Buffy fan. Our former co-host Glenn will go on at length that I still owe him the last two seasons of Buffy. But, and yes, I will eventually finish them. There's a promise made. I am a man of my word. I would come back as a lich just to finish watching the show to fulfill this promise, right?
And then Buffy would kill you.
And then Buffy would kill me. I would hope she'd just send Angel, because I think he's a far better hero. But that's a whole nother story. But I love those later seasons, because what I connected with, and maybe it's because I was working in the corporate world at the time, was I connected with that sense of futility, that no matter what you want to do, there's always going to be this serious push to not do that. You'll get celebrated for your wins. You'll get lauded for the good jobs. But at the end of the day, when the company is in opposition with your moral code, that's when you start getting the demerits. And I significantly connected with that. And in fact, I'm probably one of the few people that love the ending of this series, because it ended with, this won't stop. Mm-hmm. They end it in a way that's, and it keeps going. You can't beat this machine. They didn't defeat them. They stopped the menace of the day. And then there's a new battle, and that's how the show went out.
Take the end of the sprint, yeah.
And I absolutely thought that was very poetic and narrative, dramatic, all the wonderful things. And I love when that type of sensibility seeps, to use the dramatic term, into my gaming. As a person who does a lot of political stuff in my games and often has to be told, hey, we got to rein this back for publication of shade. I love when I get my mitts on a slightly different genre within the space that doesn't have to rein it in quite as much as I may have to for some of the things we do. Because I really cling on to that stuff. And Josh says, yes, he does.
Yeah, he does. Stage one clinger over there. Okay, Mr. Miller, stage two.
Stage two.
Maybe you're a worse clinger than a stage two clinger.
It's quite possible.
Welcome to the middle of the show. We wanted to take a minute and thank the people who helped make this show possible, our Patreon supporters. We like to shout out our adventurer level Patreons, so extra big thanks to Tim Morris, Joe Harney, Dave Rideout, Adam Scaramella, and Marty Napier. Patreon supporters get exclusive content, free copies of all of our published and unpublished game supplements, early access to episodes, and free invitations to our monthly games. You can learn more at www.patreon.com/ttjourneys.
Speaking of published material, have you checked out the supplements we have on DM's Guild? We have two full books: Traveler's Guide to Collaborative Worldbuilding, The Traveler's Guide to the Multiverse, and you can combine it with all of our supplements to make your next role legendary. Go to www.ttjourneys.com/DMsGuild for more information.
If you're looking for Tabletop Journeys swag or need a fantastic set of new dice, then you should check out the Tabletop Journeys Spring Store and our affiliate, FanRoll Dice. You can make your first purchase through FanRoll at 10% off, and every purchase helps support the show. You can learn more about that at www.ttjourneys.com/fanroll. And if you want to get some awesome t-shirts, hoodies, hats, or other gear, check out www.ttjourneys.com/swag to get redirected to our Spring Store. These are the same vendors that we use for our add-ons when we do Kickstarters and stand by their products.
But the best way you can support the show is by joining the conversation. Did you love one of the episodes? Did you disagree with something we said? Maybe you just want us to cover your favorite game system a little more, or talk about a brand new system. Check us out at linktr.ee/ttjourneys. That's our link tree. And join the conversation.
We hope you're enjoying this week's show. So here comes the second half. Don't forget to subscribe to the show wherever you're listening to us. And if your platform lets you leave a comment or a rating, why not hit the button and show your support? Thanks again for listening. And now on with the show. Number two, Mr. Miller, your question, sir.
All right.
Now we get into the fun questions, Caleb, too. Like, we've got the meat and potatoes questions out of the way. So yeah. Now we get into the fun stuff. Yeah. So,
okay, good. Because I'm over here like,
I know. I'm sure you're bored. Exactly. Yeah.
As we were convincing, we were talking a bit about the video vignette and how that expressed the undercurrents of the game and kind of the setting that you were developing. I did want you to tell us more about the tone of the game for our audience that may not have gotten hold of your Kickstarter just yet, may not have had that opportunity. What can you tell us about the overall tone of the game in general as written and what you would want general managers to be able to do with the game at their tables?
A key part of all of it for me is that one of our goals, and I'm sure we'll talk about this a little bit later, was to make a rule book that was not only readable, but that enhanced the act of play if you did read it. Like, I wanted to make a game where you would feel comfortable telling all your players, like, I promise, if you sit down and read the first 40 pages of this book to learn how to do it, not only will you learn the game, but you will also have a good time and come to the game with something.
Yeah, you'll understand the game, yeah.
Yes. And I think that not every single rulebook has the opportunities that we have with this particular genre and with this particular message to create an in-universe document, which is what it is. It's a document that is intended to put you in the world as soon as you start reading. But it also, it's very flexible. Like, paranormal fiction is very flexible. And horror, even if you were to zoom out a little more, horror broadly is very flexible, which allows me to mix, like, stuff that's a little scarier or stuff that's a little more intense with also a lot of comedy. And I think that the game, by the time you finish reading the rulebook, you can tell that the game is, it invites very wacky stuff that is meant to be the connective tissue between a couple of, like, much more difficult and much more serious choices. Plus, the game is in a modern setting, and not just any modern setting, it's like in your world. You can put it anywhere in the world. And so it doesn't require a lot of like lore knowledge or like prior thinking very hard about like how you fit into a particular place. You're making real people that live in a real space. So for our game, to answer your question about general managers and what I think they should be able to do, what the game is intended to support is to make it easy for you to not only feel like you're telling the story to the people at the table, but that you're getting to engage. You have mechanics that you get to actually participate in as a GM. You have a currency that you get to spend. And you get the support of a text that is providing you with abilities and structure that is intended to make your play, I would say, supplemented by outside writing at various points that is going to keep the tone fun and keep the tone interesting and invite questions that are a little more complicated than is this a success or a failure? In almost all cases, a success and a failure that you are rolling for in our game come with a prompt, come with a small bit of additional business that creates more story for you. So I guess I hope you have an easy time making a funny and scary adventure.
I absolutely love, let me say this again, love meta currencies for GMs.
Yeah.
Once you build in a meta currency that goes beyond just the player side of what used to be a GM screen, and you start giving that flow, like what the players do can or will give the GM some, and what the GM does may or may not give some back to the players. However those mechanics work, whatever that mechanism is, you are taking this out of, you're the players, I'm the entertainer. There's no minstrel show here. I am a player. I just have a different role. And as I have played games that do more of that lately, the last couple of years, I love GMing D&D. I love GMing all kinds of games. I just like storytelling. I like to be creative in that way. But I got to tell you, when I am most excited, it does tend to be in games that have GM meta currency. I love the fact that as a GM, when I am ready to visit havoc and chaos upon my players, they watch that transaction happen. I can set, there are three bad guys here, there's four bad guys there, the enemy's waiting on the ship. That's the scenario. when things start happening, but I realize it's going too fast, or they're going to get to the solution a little more easily than would be narratively fun and enjoyable. Like the challenge just dropped out of this because of different things. In any game I'm the GM, I always have the ability to do that. But the feel of play from the player side is less because that's recognized. We were winning and all of a sudden now we're not.
Yes.
That feels terrible. I've been there. When there's a meta currency involved, however that happens, because that's a transaction that everybody watches, now it's just part of the game. And the fact that I made this more challenging and more fun, because they still have to trust me to not do it in a vindictive way or in a way that's going to build the story.
Rule number one is still in effect, right?
Because it was out in the open and they saw that happen, they feel better about it. Yeah. We all enjoy it more. I love that kind of thing. I wish more games did it. And I love the fact that your game does.
I'm going to totally tangent for a second here. And Caleb, I apologize because you and I talked about this probably a couple months ago now. I was talking about how, because we've been playing a lot of Star Trek Adventures, which has a really robust kind of meta currency, the threat and momentum dynamic that kind of goes back and forth. Both sides of the screen have their own meta currency and they interact with each other and blah, blah, blah. And I was talking about like how to go ahead and do that because I'm starting a new D&D campaign with some brand new players. And I was like, I really want to go ahead and work in some sort of a meta currency thing, but I'm not totally sure how to do it. And I figured it out. Basically, the way that the meta currency runs very simply is that anytime there is a natural one rolled at the table, I, as the storyteller, get a d20. It just sits on the table and I can use it whenever I want. So for as many as that are there. So if player attacks me and I don't want them to succeed, I can then roll another d20 and they have to go ahead and stick with the new roll. My bad guy tries to hit and doesn't hit, I get to roll another d20. Saving throw, whatever. Whatever a d20 roll would be called for, if I have a d20 in the crit pool, I can go ahead and pull one and re-roll for them. And that's been the cleanest and easiest way that I've found to go ahead and make it work so far. And it is a ton of fun.
Love that.
It's just a ton of fun because it's super simple. So, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and I was going to say, in our game, like, to talk a little bit about where that came from. So our metagame currency is called Chaos, and the way that it works is every time you roll the 64, like y'all did at the beginning of this, anything that's not a 3 gives the GM 1 point of chaos. And the GM basically has a little shop that has a variety of different effects that they can spend the chaos on. And in the natural flow of the game, the idea is that you look to that chaos table basically anytime there's a dull moment, anytime there's a pause, see how much you have and spend as much as you can. Make the biggest mess you can.
Yeah.
And I think most of what we've done with that, with the rules of the game and how the chaos is spendable, is exactly stuff that GMs who have GM'd for a long time have as a toolkit in the back of their head when they're running other types of games. Okay, I could up the stakes here by killing an NPC, or I could make the evil effect take one step forward into the world. But I really wanted to resist numeric results. I didn't want to do a system where what we were doing was moving like an HP bar back and forth, which I think works really well for a lot of TTRPGs, like with clocks and stuff like that, but was something I was actively trying to avoid, was like numbers at every possible space I could, unless they were like extremely important numbers. We have jokes about that in the book, even about how low the numbers are.
Yeah.
But in the end, what I wanted to do was create a game that invited people who had not been GMing for a long time to see behind the curtain of what people who had been are always thinking, and teach pace by showing you, like, this is the point in the story where you probably want to kill someone. This is the point of the story where you want to make a big mess. But do that through the numbers. And just like you say, the most important thing to me is making sure that everybody has the buy-in at the table, where when that happens, it feels like a big deal. And what's so funny about the chaos system is that so much of our game is in-universe and playing with the idea that you're immersed in the world. The chaos system is one of the times where it really invites you to understand that you're playing a game. Like the GM says, I'm spending 4 points to kill this person. I'm spending this much to do this. And what's so funny is I think those are the points where a lot of the players actually do feel the most immersed.
Yeah.
Because you understand that there's threat there. You've known it was sitting there the whole time.
Yep. I could not agree more, and I'm so enamored with the fact that's part of this game. Like, when game systems come out, if they don't have some kind of meta currency, now that we're in this modern age of gaming, I get why legacy games may not do it, though WotC hashtag call your boys TT because Josh is onto something seriously cool. Damn straight. That's not just because you're one of my best friends and I love you. You're my brother and whatnot.
No, I appreciate
that's
it.
Just great. Dead up fact. That's a great way to do that because I too have been in my head. How do I get these things? There's so many things that we play all these games and we're like, okay, what can we do? TTJ, we have our own signature thing, collaborative world building. We try to put it in everything we do. Yeah. This is one of those things that's just, if it doesn't have it, it needs to. Perfect.
Totally. And so I've had a couple of questions that I wanted to go ahead and ask you, but this conversation is really pointing me I want to talk more about what you've been talking about, like the camaraderie at the table and building up everyone's a player. I'd originally thought that this was going to be an extension of what the conversation we were going to have about dice mechanics, but I'm realizing now that it's separate. What I really want to talk about is how interactive the resolution mechanics are for everybody at the table. Just the concept where everybody at the table in various situations can decide how is this going to be adjudicated. Like it wasn't a huge portion of the book, but around page 50 or so like that. And it had this fantastic scene with the two agents where one wanted to buy donuts and one wanted to buy croissants. And it was up to the GM never got involved in how that was going to be resolved. It was totally up to, okay, players, how do you want to resolve it? How much time do you want to go ahead and take to resolve this at the table? What's the best resolution mechanic that you don't, do you want to make it an opposed challenge where it's player one going against player two or whatever like that. So I want to talk about like, where did that come from? Where did that concept of kind of not only making the gameplay interactive, but the resolution mechanics so interactive also? And how has that played out at playtesting? Do you find that there's a steep learning curve to accepting that? Because it's pretty out of the box thinking.
Yeah. Yes. At the table, no. I don't think there's a steep learning curve. At the reading, like when people are reading it and not playing and they're like separate, I think that the toughest, I think that's, we do have some people who have a tough time with some of the ideas happening there, but I do want to piece apart some of what you're saying.
Sure.
Because what you're talking about is our conflict resolution mechanics, which are the rules specifically around when players get into a direct competition with one another, which this game will often invite, especially as your campaign goes forward and players are pulled in different directions depending on what faction their loyalties are moving toward. But we also have one of our like core mechanics is called Ask the Agency or Reality Alteration Roles. And the way that those work is also collaborative, where when players succeed at them, the whole table decides what in recent history is rewritten to make the result that the original player wanted. And you're exactly right that this is a very collaborative thing. Often the GM is not have to get like super involved other than just like adjudicating what our like stat qualities are a part of it. But I think honestly, the thing people have the toughest time with is that our game doesn't have skill checks. It doesn't have a reaction to a player being like, I don't know if I can jump over this cliff or not.
Yeah.
What our game tells you is that you can't. Everybody's playing normal people except for their superpowers. And so if you ever want to solve a problem, you have to actively use one of the many superpowers available to you. And I think that is what people have the toughest time with because it is a very ingrained and normal TTRPG rhythm to say, I want to do this. Can I do it? Let me roll to see and potentially I fail.
Yeah.
To tell you why this came about, it's because of a few things. One is that I tend to look at TTRPGs as an opportunity for group storytelling. And after spending a lot of time, like I said, as a professional GM, I have a bad taste in my mouth for the weight of a like D&D GM's job. And not just the weight, but exactly what was making my job possible. The fact that the GM is in many cases a performer whose job it is to build the set and the script and play all the characters and get in front of you and do a dance. And that's not how all the best tabletop games go. I think a lot of like personal local games don't feel like that, even in D&D. But in my particular position, I had been doing a job where that basically was my job. I really did have to do that to make the thing that I was bringing to the table valuable. And it helped me see what was cool about that, but also got me to the point where I just didn't want to do it anymore ever again. So if I was going to make a game, it was not going to be set up that way. So I wanted something that had a lot of group storytelling. I wanted something that invited everybody to be involved as often as possible at the table, even if they weren't the one participating. And so that led to this rolling system that invites other players to be involved as much as possible. The conflict resolution system, which, as you mentioned, allows players to break the rules of the game however they want at the point where they're fighting to do the coolest fight possible, leading to whatever outcome they decide as a group is the most interesting. And then also, I think a key part of this is the relationships rules, which is that all the main NPCs in a character's life aren't just played by the GM, they're played by other people at the table. And so as a result, you have a game where scene to scene, you are probably playing two people. You're probably helping out with someone else's role. You're probably giving recommendations for what happens in a scene. And everybody is a part of that, hopefully, almost all the time.
Yeah. It's so cool how many like little pieces of, and I don't, I certainly don't mean this to be derogatory. This is absolutely a compliment. I 100% promise. But how like little pieces of so many different games are making their way into the game. Like I'm thinking about like that bit right there where you're playing both your primary character and the NPC related to STA, where you're playing your primary character and a secondary character. So you mm-hmm. may have a scene where one or the other of your characters is involved. Very rarely is it both, but that thread is weaving its way in, and that's how new games are made. You take 100 threads from 100 different games and you weave them into a new pattern and boom, now you have a new game. So I love that. I love how forward thinking the threads that you pulled are. That's fabulous to me. Yeah.
That's very sweet. And that does not bother me at all. But just like I was trying to say earlier, I think the fun of making something is like pulling out what you like from across a broad spectrum of things and putting them in a combination you think will say something new. Really happy with how that came together.
I think this is a great spot for us to break away and jump into our Patreon exclusive, because I wanted to delve into this area a little bit, very similar to what Josh was saying. For those of you who are listening to the show, if you are not a patron, hashtag call your boys TTJ. Join the Patreon. We've got all kinds of levels for every budget. And then you get access to Patreon exclusives, such as what our patrons are about to hear.
Right, we are back. Thank you for listening. And if you are one of our Patreon subscribers, you can go check out that exclusive content right on Patreon. And if you are not, make sure you go to www.patreon.com/TTJourneys. You can catch all the exclusive content. You can get early access to all of our episodes, and you can get invites to our monthly Patreon exclusive tabletop games. So
details again. You can hear about cowboys kissing.
Exactly. Who doesn't want to hear about cowboys kissing?
I'll saddle up.
Nope. Nope.
I'm nodding. They're shaking their heads. I'm nodding.
Yeah. I went there.
All right.
We've got I said earlier, I'll be here all week.
I can't even with you tonight. All right, Caleb, we've got time for one more question tonight. Maybe I'll give you the option here. Which question do you want to answer? Do you want to answer about the in-game, out-of-game nature construction of the book, or do you want to talk about the 64 mechanic?
Ooh.
I know, right?
I don't know. Which question is better? Ask me the better question.
64. 64.
All right. So Lee Winnie wants me to ask about the 64 question. And I wish that the question was super sexy. I'm guessing that the D4 mechanic kind of was born over the fact that the D4 is triangle shaped and it's triangle agency. And like that's where the connection is,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So I'm assuming that's what it was, but I want to give you the opportunity to go ahead and correct me if I'm wrong. It's entirely possible. But regardless of kind of the origin of why you use the D4, I want to talk about what are the unique challenges of crafting resolution mechanic. I know that there's not a ton of resolution mechanics, but even the ones that you do have, when the die rolls come up, like what are the unique challenges that emerged from having to use that system? It's like a PBTA style successes system, but not really.
Yeah. So the way that it works, we've touched on it a little bit, but the way that it works is you roll 6d4, you check for threes, which again is about the triangle.
Sure.
Anything that's not a three creates chaos. If you have three threes, you get a critical success called transcendence. And otherwise, as long as you have at least one three out of all six of them, you succeed. There's other stuff that affects that. There's a thing called burnout that can lower the amount of threes that are effective in your roll. But fundamentally, that's how the roll works. I think the biggest challenge is it's hard. Because it's hard to call it a challenge because what I had was a lot of fun. Basically, the D4 thing, absolutely 100%, like many things in this book, started as a joke. Was like, right. Can I make something with just D4s? Because they are the triangular die, and obviously this company would like these the best.
Sure.
And then as I started digging into it, it opened up a really interesting possibility for me that lined up with the other stuff we've been talking about today. One of those things being, I wanted a game where success was close to guaranteed. I wanted players to have most of the time an opportunity to succeed so that the bulk of roles are contributing to that chaos economy, creating this kind of like forward-thinking, quote-unquote, mixed success that is extremely flexible and doesn't require the GM to respond in the moment, and instead can wait and hold that currency until the most exciting time. I think the way that the system itself ended up getting built started as me playing with the D4 and thinking through what all I could do with it, not wanting to have a very straightforward 25% success case, and then adjusting the number of D4 to hit the approximate like chances that I wanted. So getting 3 threes with trisendence is like close to a 10% chance, which is actually higher than you are going to get a critical success in like a D20 roll. But it feels weirder. It feels less likely because you're rolling 6 die. So if you don't look up the numbers, you're like, this is wild. I've got 6 of these and half of them got the one number I needed. So that feeling is really cool. And I also just really wanted to showcase the possibilities of doing something a little bit stranger. And this is a very funny tactile reasoning, but I also did not want a system that only rolled 1 die or only rolled 2 die at a time. I wanted a system that let people get the feeling of, I have a handful of dice. I am rolling a handful of dice, in part just because I think that activity at the table is one of the only like live physical activities you get to do in a tabletop game. So it's very important and it needs to be something that feels satisfying. I find a D20 roll interesting. I think it's a very successful resolution mechanic to roll a D20 and look for the number. I don't find that as exciting to do as like a damage roll where you get to roll like six-sided dice or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I wanted it to happen as much as possible. I wanted it to be the triangles. And I wanted it to be a system that when people heard about it, they would go, what?
Yeah.
So I think it succeeds at all of that.
I'll be honest. When I first started reading the book, I was like, oh, okay, so it's going to be a Caltrop Core book. Because Caltrop Core was like the big thing that came out like 2 years ago. It was all D4 based. And I was like, and as I started reading, I was like, ooh, no, it is not. That is not what this is. Okay. this is something new and different. And yeah, again, it's like we talked about earlier. Like, it seems like it has its origins in kind of a PBTA style success mechanic, but it's also really different. Like, you're only aiming for threes. You're not aiming for a range of dice. There's no kind of graduated success. It's success is binary. You either got threes or you didn't, and that kind of thing. So, and the odds that, like, on my initiative roll here, where I rolled 6 die and did not get a single 3, that's the oddball, right? That's the outlier here. So it's like, okay, cool. I just gave the DM a bunch of chaos and didn't succeed. Fabulous. That's fantastic. That's a great situation. So you're welcome. But yeah, no, I love that. I love the fact that the D4 was picked as an in-joke. Like, that makes my heart sing. Like, that's, we were talking about the Make 100 campaign earlier that we did, and the Make 100 campaign is very much, it's an in-game book. It's a list of magic items. It's a catalog that's assembled by this cleric that lives in a far-off village kind of thing. And it, at the beginning of the book, is this letter from him saying, I have journeyed long and far, and I have found these items, and some of them may be mythical and everything like that, but here's how I have detailed all these magical items. What backers don't know yet, and this may be a surprise, is that there's also going to be
a
letter included in the book from another rival cleric that basically says, you can't trust him. None of this is true. Basically, as a nod to storytellers, like, these don't ever have to appear in your game. They don't have to be real. And that basically the letter basically ends is, none of these things are actually real if you don't believe them to be thing. So it's very much like playing, it's like the wink and the nod of, hey, by the way, yeah, I may be giving you all these magic items and they're phenomenally powerful and there's all sorts of quest ideas, but don't ever feel like you ever need to use anything that's in this book, because it could all just be bullshit. So
some are bullshit and others are real. They can send you after 3 things, but that 4th one is just not legit.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and I love that.
Something that speaks to for me that I don't know that I've talked about very much about it in the construction of this game is that part of the D4s come from a joke, and they come from trying to do something like, in some ways, like fun for the sake of just being fun and being unusual. A lot of what we wanted to do with this game, and that it sounds like your alternate question, so maybe I'll answer a little bit of that here. A lot of what we wanted to do with this game was like invite people to really approach it fresh, like really. Get by the time you are into the rules, we want people to hit a point where they realize, oh, I need to pay attention. Like, I need to be thinking about what I'm doing here. And one way you do that is by earning it, I think, and by revealing that nothing in the game was going to let you assume what it was going to be. And like nothing in the game was going to let you like sit back and be like, oh, I understand for sure how this mechanic works, or like I understand for sure where this is going. And by our goal, whether we're successful is something people can still adjudicate for themselves at any time, but our goal was to make something that rewarded you for getting to that point, that let you feel in on the jokes and on the process that's happening in front of you, let you see rewards for engaging with the rules themselves in a deep way. And we got there by having a little bit of story be told to you as you read it, and have your campaign be set up with these like tentpole ideas that are introduced to you over time. But I think every bit of it, from the dice mechanics to the choice to make it an in-universe document to the resolution mechanics being the way they are, was all in service to my belief that at every step of the way, even if we weren't doing something perfect, we needed to be doing something at least a little bit new. And I really hope that comes through and feels good for people when they're reading.
Yeah, I thought that it did.
Absolutely did. Yeah. And when you were talking about the dice in specific, one of the things that I picked up on was how much of your experience being a professional GM must have lended to your feelings about what has the best feel for your players. I made a decided point to go to as many conventions as possible and do as many live events as I possibly could to rebuild some of those skills back from when I used to game and run games twice a week or whatever. And I wanted to really get back into that feel of it. As we are writing more and more content, I needed to have a better connection with what feels good at the table. Doesn't matter the system, to just understand when you see people smile, when you see people get on the edge of their seat, when you see them drone off and start looking at their phone, and know what those beats are and are not, so that you know what to put into your content. And what you described with the dice is exactly what I sense. Like, knowing when a roll is necessary and when it's tedious is critical. When you have currency mechanics, it becomes even more important to know when to call for a roll. So not everything requires a roll. Yeah, sometimes you're just going to say, yep, you can do it. Or don't worry about it, you got it. Sometimes you want a little bit of chance for that chaos in there. So it's going to be a pretty easy one, but roll anyway. When you're running games on a consistent basis, knowing when you get that tactile feel is so important. I consider that when we're building just weapons and items, I'm like, the natural construction of this is it should just be a graduated dice. It should just go to a D10, but I would much rather you roll 2D8 or
2D6.
Mechanically, the number is almost non-different, but 3D6 is always going to be better than 2D8. Always.
I also want to take, speaking of magic items, I want to take this big shot pitch at whoever here is, I'm not interested in this game at all. It doesn't sound interesting to me, period. The latter third of this game has 200 bespoke magical powers built into it that come from my years of creating magic items and creating magical effects bespoke for players in other games. And so if you ever just need a big, weird book to pull a strange thing out of, this is the one for you.
It is a big, weird book to pull stuff out of. That's the best description.
But I saw it.
Yeah.
And I loved it. I loved it.
Yeah. So if you are not interested in playing the Triangle Agency, I said it again, I said the thus. So if you are somehow not interested in playing Triangle Agency, do yourself a favor. Don't just listen to our show on it. Check out the Kickstarter. Check out the videos that they did. Check out the other stuff there. The links and everything are going to be down in the show notes down below. Check this game out. It is weird and wonderful in all the best ways. Caleb, I loved the book. I loved reading through this. And I really appreciate you taking some time tonight in the dog days of summer here to go ahead and talk about it. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate you taking the time. Yeah, this is a fantastic time. Just to let you know what's coming up on the show in the next couple of weeks here. So we are going to be, with August coming and the heat of the year beginning to ratchet up here, we're going to be talking a lot of new content over the next couple of weeks here. So we're going to be starting next week talking about some of the precursor material to the D&D 2024 revision that's coming out. We have an episode on Tales of the Valiant coming up soon. We have an episode on STA's second edition coming up soon. We have a bunch of new stuff coming up on the show in the next few weeks. projects here, as well as Star Trek Preservation's. Once again, Caleb, thank you very much for joining us. Before we let you go here, let folks know on the show here, and again, we'll have all this down in the show notes also, but where can folks find you and where can they find Triangle Agency?
Yeah, absolutely. So the online place I'm still on the most is Twitter at CZaneH, or you can look up Haunted Table, which I also is where most of my tabletop role-playing game tweets go now. You can check out Triangle Agency and maybe get a physical copy for yourself at shop.hauntedtable.games. You can also check out our itch.io page, which I believe is hauntedtable.itch.io, to look at the digital editions, and there's samples of everything. So we have a sample of the core book, and we also have two missions from our 12 mission book that was released alongside of it that are available for free as well, including one written by me that is one of my favorite pieces of tabletop gaming I've ever written, a mission called Nosedive. I also recently, there's a relatively new actual play podcast called The Astonishing Adventures of the SS Bad Ship, where we play scum and villainy a little bit, and I play a robot in that. That has been a lot of fun. It's straightforwardly just a very silly comedy. We are hanging out and making jokes for most of the time, but if that sounds fun to you, check it out. And that's the best. You can also come. I'm always around and talking to people in our Haunted Table Discord, which is discord.hauntedtable.games you can go to. And I'm always available to answer questions and talk about the game there.
Awesome. Thanks very much, Caleb. Once again, appreciate you taking some time tonight to go ahead and talk us through Triangle Agency, and really looking forward to diving through those magic items. That's the first look that I did through those was an awful lot of fun. I'm going to be diving into that a little bit more.
Thank you so much.
I love when I can read something that both creeps me out and makes me want to keep reading. That is a fine line, because I am generally the nope guy. Yeah. Generally, if I'm creeped out, I'm like, and I'm done.
Yeah.
And I'm out. But I appreciate good writing. I appreciate good story. And this is that. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
All right, everybody, that is our show for tonight. Like I said, next week we'll be talking about some of the precursor material for the D&D 2024 release, looking through some of the official and unofficial stuff that has come out about what we think may be in that book. So looking forward to that. Once again, Caleb, thank you very much. And yeah, everybody out there, thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Good night, all.
Thank you for joining us. This has been Tabletop Journeys. We would love to hear your feedback on our show today. Join us at www.ttjourneys.com, where you can subscribe to the blog to leave comments and see all the content that we publish beyond the podcast.
You can also stay in touch by subscribing to our Twitter, Tumblr, or Instagram at ttjourneys, joining our Facebook group, Tabletop Journeys, or by sending an email directly to podcast@ttjourneys.com. Our full episodes come out every week on Friday, and every Tuesday features actual play and gameplay showcase episodes. Looking for early access? You can support the show and get episodes before everyone else at www.patreon.com/TTJourneys. Check it out today and see all the awesome benefits we bring to our supporters.
Lastly, if you're listening to us on Stitcher, iTunes, Podchaser, Spotify, or Audible, we would really appreciate it if you would like and subscribe to the podcast on that platform. Thank you for listening and for being a part of our growing community. And we bid you fair tides, friends, for Legends Await.